It would be impossible to overemphasize the importance of this text, the ladder, or the ladder of divine ascent, as it's sometimes called, by St. John Climacus. It is of vital importance in understanding the spirituality of the Christian East, not only from a historic perspective, but also at the present time. Because, as I've mentioned at several points during this course, and in the introductions to this material on the webpage, this text is read every year by every Orthodox monk and nun. It is the standard reading that is intended to form the conscience and provide information about the spiritual life, and it is used both by those being formed and those involved in spiritual formation. Climacus himself lived from about 570 to 649, a very tumultuous time in the history of the Christian East, and it would not be an overstatement to say that things were deteriorating, what with the rise of powerful forces that were dismembering the Eastern Church. Climacus himself was a monk in the monastery of St. Catherine's on Mount Sinai, and he joined there as a novice at about the age of 16. He lived for many years as a hermit and eventually became the abbot of Mount Sinai. He wrote his ladder of divine ascent, as it's sometimes called, or ladder of paradise, which is another name that is given to it, as a model for developing spiritual life. And he includes within it, or he tries to create within it, a notion of 30 steps within a ladder. You might remember the ladder leading to heaven that implied the virtues according to which we rise that we saw in the texts by St. Perpetua, the repetition of this theme to some extent by John Cassian, but a particular emphasis on it by St. Benedict in his Ladder of Humility. It becomes a standard monastic model or theme. And here there are 30 steps corresponding to one tradition about the years of the life of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, that there are 30 steps corresponding to each of his years. And so they're read not so much in a sequential fashion as you have to have the first step before the second, although there is some of that in the text, but providing a kind of an organizing principle to 30 themes which he develops, as we'll see, which culminate in the notion of faith, hope, and charity, the great theological virtues towards the end, apatheia, freedom from overwhelming compulsions, is a very important theme towards the end as well, and the stronger emphasis on the development of the classical monastic practices and virtues coming early on in the steps. We'll be looking at the first three chapters and then looking at the texts on discernment and the highest rungs of the ladder in two separate lectures. What you find when you look at this text by St. John Climacus is a very different tone from what we found in the earlier writings of St. Benedict. And I think it's not too far off the mark to say that to some extent this represents the worldview of an empire that is disassembling, that is crumbling at the time of Climacus to some extent. There is uncertainty in the world. Certainly things are much worse in the West than they are in Climacus East. But even in the East, lines of communication are breaking down. Firm centers of Christian devotion and Christian life are being transformed into other kinds of things. There's a sense that what was precious and valuable in the past is in danger of being lost. And so Climacus himself, although he has a lot of his own material, and indeed it wouldn't be far off to say that virtually every passage of the latter is crafted and shaped by him, Climacus is attempting to create not only a textbook of his own, but also a compendium of what went before, although he most often does not give his sources. So as we look at this, it's important to bear in mind that it brings together a lot of genres that we've already seen. It includes apothegmata, brief sayings, although they're not often attributed to the fathers from which they come. There are more extended, rather more gnomic chapters, rather reminiscent of Evagrius, and indeed some of them are quotations from Evagrius' works, although, again, not attributed to Evagrius. In fact, Climacus had a strong antipathy towards Evagrius for some of the advice that he offered, and Climacus was deeply critical of the attempt on Evagrius and Cassian and others to be rather precise in terms of which vices come before which and what leads to another. Climacus felt that this is a bit more variable from person to person, and that one could construct multiple systems and one shouldn't be bogged down by a system. So it can give his work a sense of a lack of cohesion or a lack of clarity. I think it's important to realize that it really is an anthology. It's not a continuous narrative. It includes brief chapters. It includes long runs of macrisms. Blessed is the person who does this or that. It includes little alphabets or what one might call mnemonic devices intended to help people memorize the virtues they should be pursuing, interspersed with Climacus' own commentary, his citations from other sources, and his citations from a variety of different genres. So the work is very much an anthology, although it's sometimes not altogether clear where one form of text begins and another breaks off. I have used a numbering system which is not consistent in the versions of the latter that are written. There is as yet no critical edition of this text, although it is being worked on, and what we look forward to the production of a text that will include a division of these chapters in a way that can be consistently referred to, and also a version of the text that will give reference to all of his sources, but again, that doesn't yet exist. Although there are a couple of English translations that are available, one available through Paulist Press and the Classics of Western Spirituality, and another older translation which I've made available for download on the course documents portion of the website. So if you wish to read more of Climacus and probe more deeply into his approaches, you're welcome to do that with the full downloadable text. We're going to have to move rather rapidly through this very brief set of selections from his writings. Let's begin with step one on renunciation of the world. And as with so many other authors that we have seen, he attempts to create a kind of a model of different kinds of people or different kinds of beings in order to give his reader a sense of what they're striving for. And so in number 1.1, he divides up all beings into five categories: the friends of God, the true servants of God, the worthless servants of God, those who claim to be serving him but are not, some of the others who are estranged from God, and finally God's opponents, his enemies. And he explains this a little further on when he says that friends of God are basically the intellectual and incorporeal beings which surround God, that is to say, principally the angels. The true servants of God are those who are committed to serving God and actually do it. Worthless servants, according to Climacus, are those who have been baptized but haven't kept their vows, either their baptismal vows or perhaps they've entered monastic life and haven't been faithful. And then moving further away, we have those who are estranged from God and made his enemies, and these are specifically the unbelievers or heretics, those who deny the faith or have renounced the faith or do not profess the faith. And finally, he says the adversaries, the true enemies, the soldiers against God, are those who not only evade and reject his commandments, but are waging war on those who fulfill it. And those are, of course, particularly the demons. So he describes in 1.2 that there might be a treatise for each of these things, but his principal goal is to write for and about the true servants of God. So that model or that image is kind of giving us, if you will, a vista of the whole of creation, the ways in which one can move towards God and aspire to being as true a servant as the angels are, but a recognition of the fact that one can far fall away from God, and that can lead one into heresy, and holds out the horrifying specter of the demonic, who are completely opposed to and even waging war against God. We have to try to be on the side of the angels and the side of those who are seeking the Lord. God belongs, he says in 1.3, to all free beings. He is the salvation of all. And then in number 1.4, he advocates the imitation of God. He there also describes distinctions between the Christian who imitates Christ, the lover of God, who is in communion with all that is natural and sinful, the one who is continent, who is able to maintain balance in the midst of temptations and snares, and then the monk. And of course, he's writing as a monk for monks, and so the monastic state for him is very high in his hierarchy of ways of serving God. And as I've mentioned elsewhere, he is particularly fond of monastic asceticism and even approves of forms of asceticism that we would today regard as rather extreme or harsh. He talks about the monk being that mourning soul, in the sense of mourning over over sin, who is both asleep and awake, unceasingly occupied with the remembrance of death. So the memory of death is for him a meditation on mortality, is fundamental to the life of those who aspire to live the proper life of monasticism. And then in 1.5 he tries to make a distinction among those who are God's true servants, between those who have left the world, who have engaged in this separation for the sake of the future kingdom, or because of awareness of their sins, or out of love for God. Now, this is not a very careful ordering, and indeed, I think one finds throughout Climacus' works, he does make these distinctions, and he often creates a kind of a spectrum, but sometimes the spectrum is borrowed and then added to in his own way, but often not carefully thought out. So there are certainly inconsistencies, and in some cases one might even say, well, why didn't he put number 2 before number 3 and things of that sort? And that's a legitimate criticism. He's writing in a kind of a not so much offhand way, but a way that probably comes out of his own conferences given to members of his community. So he's not a systematic theologian by any stretch of the imagination. He is a compiler and a commentator on received texts. So he mentions, if we drop down to number 1.7, the very great importance of having a spiritual director. He talks about those who, as he puts it, go out of Egypt to fly from Pharaoh, to fly from sin, to fly from the devil. They deceive themselves if they imagine they have no need of a director, because those who left Egypt had Moses as their guide. And so for Climacus, having someone to whom one opens one's heart, and at the end of number 7 he says, a director who is an expert and a physician, a iatros, who is capable of using healing remedies when we open our hearts to this individual, this for him is an absolutely vital component of one's spiritual life. And of course this text is intended also for spiritual directors who are supposed to draw from it some of the received wisdom which Climacus himself recommends. If we drop down at number 1.9, there's a lovely little phrase, they must leap into the fire if they expect the celestial fire to dwell in them. This is his metaphor for engaging in the good fight, his recommendation of severe and extreme forms of asceticism. It may seem fiery, but the goal, and this is a positive one, the goal is that the celestial fire may dwell within us. So it isn't just meditation on death, it isn't just a kind of a very negative focus on sinfulness and an abhorrence of sin. It's also a desire that this celestial fire, this transcendent presence of Christ, must dwell within the heart. And it might be well also to remember that in his own monastery of St. Catherine's in Sinai, Climacus would have had the joy of being able to look up to that glorious icon of the Transfiguration, which is one of the great gifts of the early church to us today, and which still exists. So if we drop down then to number 1.10, he recommends some foundational virtues for him. These are innocence, akakia, literally absence of vice, a capacity to be free of vice, fasting, and temperance, sophroshine. So these for him are the three pillars, the three bases of the development of one's spiritual life, and he will refer to them quite frequently. Now, in number 1.14, I've highlighted, and you can compare it with the texts that are around it, he gives an analogy that is really not very successful. Some build bricks on stones, others set pillars on the bare ground, and there are some who go a short distance and, having got their muscles and joints warm, go faster. So he's giving an impression of people who are sort of turtle-like or fixed on the ground. The idea of building and then of others who are moving, one isn't quite clear. Clearly he means that there are different ways of going about about the spiritual journey and taking asceticism seriously, but he says, let him who can understand, understand this allegorical word. And this is clearly one of his own allegories, one of his own similes. And again, I think one would have to say that from the standpoint of something that is immediately clear, in the rather rabbinic sense of a parable, this doesn't really qualify very well. And so one has to be careful of rather inscrutable sayings that one finds in Climacus, which are not so much so high that it takes a very brilliant mind to understand them, but they're often just the reflection of a metaphor or a simile that probably wasn't worked out as well as it might have been. In number 126, he describes monastic life as consisting, and he describes three different kinds of retirement and solitude, that is, living in isolation and solitude, as Climacus himself did in the early stage of his monastic career, or the model which is often called the Lavra model in the Eastern Church, living in silence, in hezukia, which doesn't strictly mean just not speaking, but inward tranquility, inward silence. This is the word that's very dear to the practitioners of the Jesus Prayer, who are a much later tradition in the Eastern Church, of course, and who are referred to as hezukasts, living in inward tranquility with one or two others, or living in a koinobios, living in community, in the monastic context that is the most common form of monastic life, certainly in the West, but in the East it tends to be a very very common as well. But he recognizes three different models: the hermit life, a life of retirement and solitude, life with one or two others, and ideally with a spiritual father or a spiritual mother, and life within a community, which also includes a spiritual director or father within the community who will not be necessarily the abbot, although he doesn't go into that in great detail in this text. It's very different from the Benedictine model, at least in the early years, where the abbot was expected to be a spiritual father. In the East, the hegumenos, or abbot of the monastery, is not necessarily the spiritual father of all of the very, often very numerous members of the community. There may well be sub-communities, each having their own spiritual father within that community. If we drop down, and we're going to have to move just rather rapidly and make only a few little comments on each of these sections. Step two on detachment, he gives in a slightly more yellow highlighted area a series of what he regards as things you have to do to undertake the narrow way, to follow Christ. And you can see that they include both physical and emotional and spiritual mortification. The draft, he puts it, of dishonor, of being despised within community, treated with sneers and derision and insults. Rather dark when one considers that this is supposed to be within the community where you are being supported by your own brothers and sisters. The cutting off of one's own will, patience in annoyance, unmurmuring endurance of scorn, disregard of insult, when wronged, bearing it sturdily, slandering, not being indignant, not being angry when humiliated, being humble when condemned. So his model of community is very much one in which these things will happen and one is sanctified or purified by enduring them with patience. And he goes on to describe in 2.9 what is already described in Cassian and in earlier sources, a first, a second, and a third renunciation. This is also found in Evagrius. And for Climacus, it means number one, renunciation of external matters and factors, business and people and parents, then the cutting off of one's own will, and finally, a third renunciation of conceit, of a sense of one's own proper desires. So numbers 2 and 3 are very closely linked, and the distinction between them isn't really altogether clear, but it obviously has to do with accepting without question what you do within community. And dropping down to final section on exile, step 3, which is sometimes translated as pilgrimage, but in fact it really does mean exile. It has to do with separation from the world. And he's concerned especially to talk about detachment from things, but also especially detachment from one's parents or from one's family. In 3.11, he talks about the things that the demons will do to cause you to believe that your family is in need of you, or that you should go back to them or to the world, and he emphasizes the necessity for avoiding that. Now, rather unlike what we have seen in Athanasius in the life of Antony, and even in Evagrius. Climacus emphasizes that the demons can be known by the fact that they try to give you joy. They try to give you what he calls unholy joy and conceit. But the angels, he says, reveal torments and judgments and separations. And so if we have a dream and we wake up trembling and fearful, he says, that's most likely an angelic dream. Whereas if we wake up feeling good about our gifts or our skills or what we might become, he thinks that's most likely a demonic temptation. He says, only believe dreams, this is in number 329, that foretell torments and judgment for you. Well, specifically focused, and one might say rather bleak model, which does not represent the fullness of the tradition of discernment. It represents Climacus' own approach. He is very mistrustful of things that bring a delight, and he is encouraging his readers to particularly take seriously the things that emphasize the coming judgment. But again, this is very different from what we have seen in Athanasius. And we'll continue in the next lecture with the later sections of this text.